Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. And today, my guest is Isabel Costello, a British writer with a lifelong love of France. Having been nominated for numerous awards for her short fiction writing, she released her first novel, Paris, Mon Amour, in 2016. Her latest book, Scent, follows a perfumier's conflicting desires and intimate relationships. Isabel, welcome to Monocle Reads. I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself, because you've worked in marketing and comms, you're a book blogger, an interviewer of authors, an aromatherapist, as well as a writer. How would you describe that extremely interesting portfolio career?
Well, it's funny, actually, Georgina, hearing you reel it all off, I realised that I've had a portfolio career since before that became a thing, really. It's been incredibly interesting and exciting and varied. And in amongst all that, I took a lot of time off to raise my two sons who are grown up now. Everything I've done has contributed in some way, obviously, to who I am today. And in particular, I would say that, you know, I mean, it's a kind of aphorism that we have in the writing community that nothing is ever wasted, but I think that's definitely true of life in general. And there's nothing about my life to date that hasn't manifested itself in some shape or form.
Yeah, Nora Ephron, everything is copy.
Yeah, she's right about that.
Yeah. Listen, you're also a Francophile. Tell us about your relationship with France.
Well, you're right that I'm a Francophile. It's almost putting it too mildly. My mother was a French teacher, and my godmother is French, and her two daughters are either side of me in age and my oldest and lifelong friends. And I had the good fortune to go to France most summers of my childhood, again, before that was really a thing. I mean, my parents were not well off at all, so we were travelling on a shoestring, camping. But I did go to, I did have a lot of exposure to France and the French language growing up. And I went on to study modern languages at uni, and it's something, I mean, I just simply would not be the same person without that layer to my life.
Mm. And do you think that love of France also influenced your desire to train as an aromatherapist?
I wouldn't say so specifically. What led to that was me having this very acute sense of smell. And it seemed to really kick in when I was expecting my first son, who's now 23. And of course, that's not unusual for pregnant women, but it didn't seem to subside the way it usually does. And I'm somebody who tends to go for things with all guns blazing. So instead of just thinking, oh, that's nice, I decided to train as an aromatherapist at the Tisserand Institute, which is an amazing place to study. And I was always more interested in the creative side than the sort of bodywork side. That really fascinated me. So I think that definitely sort of laid the groundwork for my subsequent passion for perfumery.
Mm. I wonder how one starts putting together an attractive smell. I mean, how do you layer it? How do you design it? What are you looking for when you're trying to come up with something that appeals?
Well, it ties in very nicely with the process, the creative process of writing, actually, because, you know, scent is a story. I don't just mean my book of that name. So the idea would be to kind of talk to the person it's for, if we're talking bespoke scent. And it's a kind of layering not only of the chemical substances which make up the perfume, but of memory, association, desires, places, because perfume is very transporting. As many of us have kind of found during the pandemic, it's a sort of easy way to be somewhere else. It's an unbelievably complex process. And I think that's one of the reasons that the perfumery industry is quite sort of shrouded in mystique and secrecy. Because obviously perfumers don't go around sharing their, and it's a bit like Coca-Cola, you know, nobody's ever going to know the exact formula for any of these things. I actually created my own bespoke fine fragrance in the process of doing my research for this book.
And what does it smell like?
Well, it's named Paris Mon Amour after my first novel, and I was kind of channeling that novel almost more than my own self when I created it, because it's a different style to what I normally go for. So it's very sort of sexy and romantic. It's got rose, neroli, some interesting synthetics, because that's one of the things that was very interesting to me coming from an aromatherapy background, is to realise just how enormously important synthetics are in modern perfumery. And it's got some really lovely deeper notes like sandalwood, which is a favourite of mine, and leather, which is a good example of a synthetic, because obviously, you know, trying to get oil from leather wouldn't be much fun.
You talk about scent being very layered, and your book, Scent, also is very layered. It's very nuanced, and well, it's really a sort of coming of age story. I wondered if you could expand on that and just tell us a little bit more about the novel.
Well, the first person narrator of Scent is a 46-year-old perfumer called Clémentine, who's having to face up to the almost inevitable end of her marriage, her long marriage to Edouard, who's a very successful businessman. And the trigger for this, not uncommonly, is the last child leaving home. And so she's in a state of, you know, kind of big turbulence already. And that's when her ex-girlfriend from many, many years before, down in the south of France, where she comes from, just pops up back in her life completely unexpectedly. So what I wanted to kind of really tap into with this novel was this time of immense, you know, turbulence and change that women do go through in, you know, the middle decades of our lives, which, despite the kind of fact that the biggest buyers and readers of fiction are women over 40, it doesn't get represented in fiction as often as I think it should do. And also, I'm always on a bit of a personal mission to kind of counter some of the prevalent stereotypes about, you know, quotation marks, older women, many of which I just simply don't recognise. It's, you know, there's way more to it. I mean, Shakespeare compared old age to a second childhood. And I think a lot of us find midlife as women a bit like a sort of second adolescence, not just hormonally, but also in terms of all these changes that are going on. I mean, in 2017, which is the year before I sort of set to work on this book, I met up with several friends, well, quite a few, really, people that I don't see more than once or twice a year. It was like every woman I sat down to lunch or a drink with was, you know, in the midst of, you know, a real crisis, wouldn't be too strong a word, really. And quite a few of them were getting counselling or wished they could. And, you know, because there's so many issues that crowd in, you know, with elderly parents, children, career, menopause, marriage issues, or relationships, I should say. And it's a lot, you know, and therefore, as a novelist, there's a heck of a lot of mileage in there.
Totally. And it's really only recently we've seen more and more people writing about menopause. I mean, this used to be pretty much a taboo subject.
Yes, you're right. In fact, I just wrote a piece last week, interestingly, in response to Davina McCall's documentary, which I thought was really excellent. I mean, we do have to break down some of these taboos. And that requires people to be willing to speak out about it, which is, you know, it's not an easy ask, revealing kind of quite personal stuff about yourself. I mean, I was willing to do it because I think it's important. And I mean, since I wrote my first book, which is also quite sort of, you know, intimate in its tone and themes, I've started having a completely different kind of conversation with other women. And I think that people realise that I'm somebody that they can talk to who's not going to... I mean, when you've written a novel about an affair with a man who's 17 years younger, you know, it's fairly clear that you don't have, you know, very censorious views about stuff like that. And I think that a lot of unnecessary loneliness and suffering comes from not being able to talk about all this stuff, which is also, I think, quite a British thing. I mean, although I am British, the French side of my life has been so kind of almost dominant, really, that I think issues like sex, sexuality, that kind of thing, have a sort of strange, almost forbidden aura about them in Anglophone culture, which is not the case. I mean, I think all this is actually just part of life, and it's much more healthy if we can just try and see it that way rather than as some kind of enormous, you know, unmentionable elephant in the room.
Mm-hmm. One of the themes of the novel is choice, really. The choices that we make in the past, for instance, coming back to affect our lives now.
Yes, well, one of my big interests as a writer and as a person, I guess, is what contributes to who we are now. I mean, I've spent a lot of my own life kind of being, you know, fascinated by the idea of how it would feel to be someone else. And part of that is kind of questions like, can we ever really move on from things that have happened in the past and all the things which contribute to us being who we are? And finding yourself and finding your path and all that kind of thing is often presented as something which is for young people. But I see it as more of a kind of ongoing process because, you know, life throws us a lot of curveballs. And it's very fascinating to me, you know, all the different things that make us, that contribute to the way we change as people.
And do you think that age makes those choices easier to make?
Yes and no. I mean, with age, you know, you have a track record, you may well have a complicated life set up or just a very established life set up. So I think most people would say that they know themselves better as they get older. And something which seems to be a common theme amongst women as we get into middle age and beyond is that we are more forthright about what we want from life and in particular what we are not prepared to put up with. I mean, I'm encouraged to see the generation below me of women being a lot more assertive and not tolerating some of the stuff that that maybe women of my age did in the past. I mean, I don't have any daughters. I have two sons. But I mean, when I see young women, you know, taking a stand on this stuff, that pleases me.
Absolutely. I wanted to talk a little bit about sexuality then and how it changed. I mean, speaking as you do to many women in my age bracket, one thing I'm struck by, and this, of course, is a theme in your novel, is what I'm going to call late onset lesbianism. But I'm also, like you, looking back at generations that are coming up now and seeing that they are so much more at ease with their sexuality. And so I wonder if older women now becoming more fluid is something that they would have done anyway, or if this is age-related.
Ah, well, I'm very fascinated by all of this, as I'm sure you've gathered. I think that human sexuality is, you know, has always been incredibly complicated. I mean, why would it not be when every other aspect of human experience is? I mean, I'm reading a compendium of queer writing through the ages at the moment, in literally like 2,500 years. And it's quite amusing and fun because, you know, it's very clear that all these complicated nuances of sex, gender, etc., desire, have absolutely existed as long as there have been people walking the earth. I personally think it's a great thing that attitudes to this subject are loosening up. And yes, I've read tons. I mean, there's so much excellent nonfiction on this subject, and I've read a lot of it. If I had time, I'm sure I would read much more. And so sexual fluidity, it does appear to be more common in women, and particularly as we age. And that is definitely something, you know, I mean, I've noticed that in myself, for sure.
And also this, I suppose, I mean, you talk about us, you know, at 50 or 50 plus, knowing what we don't want. And I suppose there is a danger of people becoming quite dogmatic. But what happens in this book, I suppose, is that Rasha, who is the person that comes back, is Algerian. So there are cultural differences, there are class differences. And this is an example, I suppose, of an older woman really allowing her mind to be opened up.
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, when Clémentine and Rasha meet at the age of 20 down in Provence there, it's because they discover to their horror that they're both involved with the same man. And for a while, things kind of, you know, jog along between the three of them. And then he gets pushed to the side. But it's not just, I mean, it is very emotional and sexual between Clémentine and Rasha, but it's more than that. So, you know, they are from different worlds. And even though they part in very difficult circumstances and haven't seen each other for 25 years, you know, that experience is kind of seared into Clémentine on every level. And Clémentine also has a gay son, Bastien, who's just left, who's 19. So, you know, she's aware of, you know, I mean, that kind of, like, I suppose, stirs up some of her own issues from the past. I mean, she's somebody who's worked very hard at kind of suppressing her true nature, I guess you could say, because, I mean, there's a line at the close to the beginning of the book where she said, I'd seen where love could lead and I never wanted to go there again. So she deliberately marries, she knowingly marries a man that she doesn't love, almost as a sort of gesture of self-protection.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you describe, Clémentine describes her marriage as this show we're putting on, you know, the perfect exterior, the very messy interior.
Yes, well, I think that's often the way. I mean, I do personally believe that, you know, what we see of each other is, you know, the visible exterior is just the absolute tip of the iceberg. And I mean, I think that's probably one of the reasons I write. It's certainly one of the reasons I read, because, I mean, fiction is the only artistic medium that really takes us, you know, deep into the consciousness of another person in a way that, say, film and stage can't in quite the same way for all their power. Yes, you know, the vulnerability and human connection is something which interests me a lot, because you don't really get one without the other. And something I've noticed since I started writing about this kind of thing is that I have become a lot less guarded emotionally in my own right. And I'm not saying that I haven't ever thought, oh gosh, I should have kept quiet about a particular thing, but the gifts it's brought me have far outweighed any, you know, minor embarrassment or whatever.
Mm. And I think that that's really reflected in these times that we live in. I mean, we've all had such a very weird last couple of 18 months or so, whatever it's been, where emotional connection and vulnerability have really come to the fore.
Yes, absolutely. It's been very revealing of what matters most to us. And I think a lot of people have been really surprised. And I have found it incredibly difficult not being able to see my friends, especially my women friends. And I realised that, I mean, I had long thought of moving to France, which for various reasons I'm not sure will ever happen in a permanent sense. But I now kind of realise that I actually couldn't be away from my friends. I need them too much.
Absolutely. Isabel, thank you so much. I think you've given us this glorious gift in that you transport us to France. You allow us to think about our vulnerability, and you give us a cracking good story too.
Thank you so much.
Sent by Isabel Costello is published by Muswell Press. You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Thanks to my producer, Nora Hull, and researcher, Charlie Phil McCourt. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.